Welcome to the Criterion Quest, a continuing podcast series looking at important classics and contemporary films. I'm Chris, and I'm joined, as always, by my wonderful co-host, Tom.
Hello.
And we just finished watching...
Double Suicide.
The 1969 film by Masahiro Shinoda.
Did you forget the name?
Yes, I did. I needed to look at my notes for that one.
Maintain.
It's not an easy... Like, he's not a... You know, a pinnacle of Japanese cinema, like Yasujirō Ozu or Kurosawa. Like, you know, he's not.
Yeah.
The name.
Well, I'd never heard of him. If that's what you mean.
Yes. Neither had I, and I had never seen or heard of this film. So.
Neither had I.
Yes.
Let's talk about. How are we going to start? A synopsis.
Synopsis. Yeah.
So, did you want to do it? I can do it if you want.
I'm happy to do it, I guess.
Shoot then.
So, the film tells the story, I'm going to leave out a few elements here from the plot synopsis so we can kind of discuss them a bit more later. But the film is about a paper merchant who, it's set in kind of, what would you say, like 18th
century? 18th century, yeah. I think it's supposed to be in the 1720s.
Yeah. So, 18th century Japan, this paper merchant falls in love with a courtesan. And it's about how the two of them struggle and their love. Basically, he is poor and he can't afford to redeem her and buy her out of her kind of...
contract, if you will.
Her contract at the brothel. And so the two of them decide if they can't be together in this physical world, then they will kill each other and have a, you know, ritualistic double suicide so that they can be together again in the afterlife. Sort of Romeo and Juliet-esque, I guess.
Yeah, but I think a bit more... clashing heads with the rigidity of Japanese culture.
Yes.
And societal, the societal culture.
Yeah, you have the problem of, like, from her side, you have the problem of her work contract, as well as, you know, the other customers, as well as her her pimp, I guess you'd call her? Like her...
like the madame?
Yeah, the madame of the brothel, like, the kind of butting head she has with them. And then you have the husband, the man's side, where it's basically his wife, his two kids, his mother-in-law, his brother, all these people being like, you are fucking up, dude. What
yeah.
are you doing?
Yeah.
And he's like, but I love her so.
Yeah. But my selfish needs.
I'm just so lonely.
But my need.
I couldn't help but think with this film, like, every time he got sad and was just like... talking about how much he loved her, I just had Mike Yanagita from Fargo in my head. It's, you're such a super lady!
That guy is so sad, though. So depressing.
Well, so is this fucking character.
He is. It's pretty apt, actually. It's a pretty apt comparison.
Except the film is nowhere near as relevant or engaging as that single scene from Fargo.
Really? Because...
yeah. Because... I am not a fan.
Okay.
There are elements of this film, and I like the certain ones that I left out of the synopsis because it will be the meat and bones of what we go into with this podcast.
Okay.
The way that the film is actually constructed and the way that Shinoda actually makes his film is very interesting, and I applaud him for like what he's doing. But in terms of a narrative structure and in particular as well performances, I don't think the film is good.
Wow.
Yeah.
I disagree.
Okay.
I thought that the performances. Just as an example, were really quite good. There was a lot of time when the camera just held on them and they were very convincing and putting forward their all.
Those moments, though, were they talking or were they silent?
They were talking.
Okay.
There was...
because I found this film to be at its strongest when dialogue was not being spoken. In its stillness and in its quiet moments, I think the film excelled. But...
true. Strong moments when there is, say... no dialogue, imagery that is suggestive, and then you have a lovely kind of
the musical score.
Soundtrack
fantastic.
Going on with your traditional Japanese. What kind of instruments are they? Like the twanging.
Yeah, thing. It's like, kind of like a sitar. I'm imagining it's the one the guy played in Qui-Gon.
Yeah,
whatever
the Japanese sitar.
Yeah,
or whatever
that thing, that guitar. Yeah,
some kind of guitar.
Yeah,
but I thought, I mean, for example, Osan, the wife.
Yep.
She, which also, by the way, is the same actress that played, what was her freaking name? Koharu, the courtesan.
And Jihai is the husband.
Yes.
Yeah.
Her performance was very strong when it got dramatic. I mean, as you say, Jihai, he was a bit of a sad fool at times, mm-hmm. and his acting, I think, let the character down somewhat. So I can see where you're coming from, but then I really got to hand it to the actress. What's her name? Do we know her name? Or the actress? Anyway, the actress that does Kaharu and Osan. She was very strong, man.
Shima Iwasati. Iwasata.
I'm not going to remember that.
Iwashita.
We'll just call her Osan / Kaharu.
Yep.
Actress. I thought she was extremely strong. There was sequences where she was bashing heads against Jihai when she was playing Osan, and pouring out empathy towards the plight of Kaharu. And I was just like, man, this is reasonably compelling stuff.
Okay. Did you want to continue on that point, or do you... I didn't want to interrupt if you
I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah.
I thought the performance was pretty good. You thought it was not that good.
Well, okay.
But then there's can I show you this scene, perhaps?
No.
And this scene, perhaps, then maybe
I can talk about the way that I interpreted it. Like, in particular, that scene you were just saying, where... Osan has the pouring out of empathy towards Kaharu and to her husband. I found that scene in particular to be the low point of the film for me.
Oh,
yeah. Okay. mainly because we had established, like, you know, we've gone through this giant meeting with the mother-in-law and the brother, and like, sorry, her mother and the brother-in-law and, like, all this stuff, and it's like the family clashing over her husband being a fucking tool, ruining the business, ruining the family, and spending time with this prostitute and wanting to, you know, use their life savings to buy her out of her courtesan contract. And she appears to be a strong female character, and she establishes herself as like, no, this is not on. I'm now, like, you know, her mother comes and says to her, like, you've been a fool. You are a weak woman, and you're not looking after your husband. And the scene kind of ends with her trying to take some responsibility, and it's when she catches her husband crying over the courtesan that she finally kind of cracks and is like, what the fuck are you doing? But then after she finishes her giant speech about, you are ruining our family, think about what you're doing, she then flips to, but what about that poor prostitute?
Yeah.
Which I found to be baffling in terms of her character motivations. I just didn't follow her logic leap as to, like, how she could go from chastising her husband to, oh my god, we need to use all of our life savings to save this woman.
This poor
has absolutely destroyed my life.
Yeah.
I just didn't, there was nothing really to me that I saw that motivated that change. And I mean, while watching it, I got really kind of annoyed, and I chalked it up to, I guess, because this is based on an old story, he's just doing the old story, so he has to stick to that narrative plot.
But isn't it interesting that that those two roles are shared by the same actress?
Yeah.
And suggests that they're kind of one and the same. There's a solidarity between the two characters.
That's interesting, yeah.
So that might explain... It might just be... Chalk it up to maybe just artistic flair and think that... It's not logical. I agree with you. It's not logical. I was at first going, it doesn't make much sense. Why would she sell all of her kids' clothing?
Yes.
Just to save a stranger that her husband happens to love.
Yeah.
So she's kind of caught up in the moment too. She is going against what society.
So you're theorizing that the logic of her making this leap and doing something like that, like selling all of her children's clothes to save this woman, is because, in actuality, she is that woman.
Let's just say that she may have personality traits, or let's say that maybe you could say that they share a personality. There's kind of like two sides of the same coin, perhaps.
Yeah.
This is totally placing, it's reading into it.
Yes. Yeah.
I would admit that. So take it or leave it kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it's one potential explanation for why she would decide to sell her fucking kids' clothing.
Yeah.
Which is crazy.
It is.
Their decisions, both of those, all three of those people's decisions,
are foolish.
Are foolish.
Extremely.
Irresponsible. And what the fuck are they doing?
Yeah. I mean, even down to the final act of the film, which is, as you can gather from the title, a double suicide.
What do you reckon about the title, by the way? Because it spoils the ending.
Yeah. I mean, But it doesn't necessarily... If the title doesn't spoil the ending, the opening of the film does.
Oh, and when they're looking for the puppets, like the
not just not just looking for the puppets, but then it's also the shot that ends up being the last shot of the film of the two of them dead underneath the bridge.
It's like they're finding the location, I think, for the puppets to commit suicide.
Yeah. Okay. So it's kind of the film is not hiding the fact that these two people. It's like Romeo and Juliet. You know, it's the play where the lovers kill each other.
But that's only because somebody spoiled it for you.
Yeah, that's true.
Not because the Romeo and Juliet kills themselves is not the title of that play.
So what would you prefer this to be called, like The Jilted Paper Merchant or something?
That's a great name. But probably not.
No, it's too clunky.
Double Suicide's better than that.
Yeah.
But it's got a charm.
Yeah.
I don't know. What else is... I mean, there's fucking heaps to it. Let's have a look at some notes.
Well, I mean, do we want to stay on the actual narrative and the characters and the performance for now, or do we go into the actual production?
We were talking for a moment how foolish they are.
Yep.
And maybe we should bring up, like, the pressures.
Okay, yeah.
Because it might explain...
The motivations of
the
characters.
Look, I'm trying to understand your point of view.
Yeah.
I thought it was a pretty strong film. It's not the best film ever, but by any means, but...
I just found...
I'm trying to understand your point of view, because it does seem to be... They're very unlikable characters.
Yes.
In the selfishness...
Yes, yes.
...is so appalling.
And stupidity, I found, as well.
The idea that you have Ji-hai, who is prepared to go against two children,
yeah,
and a wife.
Yeah.
The future of his fucking children.
Okay.
For the sake of a love that might be just an infatuation.
See, that one I can... This is going to sound horrible to actually say out loud, but I can forgive that one.
Why? But the point is that then he's not going to just leave them. He's going to kill himself.
Yes. No, that's the issue.
This is the issue.
The issue of him abandoning his family... I can understand.
The finality of killing yourself is...
Is the baffling thing, yeah, that I find is the pinnacle of stupidity of these characters and makes them go from truly unlikable to, like, oh, these guys really fucking suck.
And it's not even a cop-out. Like, they're literally thinking, let's find paradise together by killing ourselves for the sake of our own paradise.
But it is ridiculous, and I don't understand... why they need to go to that finality, especially in the lead up to their actual suicide, when they're in the graveyard and they have sex in the graveyard, which is weird. And then it's extremely...
It's interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting. But then he cuts off his top knot.
Yes.
And she does a similar thing. And he, by doing that, he is proclaimed he is a no man now. He's a priest.
Yeah.
And similarly, she is a nun. My problem is, once they have reached this, they've now transformed. Why not stay in that transformed state and start a new life together? Why end the previous life?
Let me try and explain.
Yep.
With some history.
Ooh, okay.
So the title, Double Suicide,
yep,
translated to Japanese, is Shinju, which is... the idea or belief that if you kill yourself, if two lovers or more, it can be families that have done this as well, if they kill themselves together,
mm,
in the name of their love, they can go to heaven and unite and be there for each other, with each other forever.
Yeah.
So that is an explanation why they would be committed.
Why they would take that leap.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Simply because in their mind, they will be with each other forever.
Yes. Yeah.
Does that explain?
Yeah, no, I follow now. Yeah, but I think where...
That's a belief that was held in the Edo era?
Yeah.
Apparently.
The problem with the film now is it does not give context for that for its audience.
Yeah, well, I had to look it up.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, I mean, understandably, he's doing an adaptation of a classic Japanese story, so... theoretically, when the film was released, you know, he didn't necessarily expect it to be this giant international thing out on Criterion, yeah, and have two guys in Australia.
But it's like
critiquing,
dude,
it or whatever. But it's...
My feelings towards that is that it's a folk tale,
yeah,
for Japanese people.
So, yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, that was the point I was trying to make.
Yeah. It's like if you watched an Australian film about Aboriginals and it wasn't explaining shit for Americans.
Well, so I'm sure just... Walkabout has shit where
international
audiences are like,
What the fuck?
What the fuck?
I can't think of any right now because we'd watched that a while ago. But I would imagine that there'd be instances like that.
Well, just the general concept of Walkabout is never explained in the movie.
Of course, what the young Aboriginal boy is doing.
So yeah, I can understand that.
So I don't think you can hate a film.
No, I'm not hating it because of
good
that. But like now that you have shed light on the folktale and things, I'm now a little bit more forgiving and understanding of why they do ultimately commit suicide, because that was bothering me. Like why they've already undergone this transformation of character.
Yeah.
Why not? Why is that not enough?
It's like a complete... I'm looking at it like it's a complete transcendence to kill yourself together.
Yeah.
Rather than
a partial one, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, interestingly, this is actually... I read the essay that was on... That is coupled with the film.
Yep.
And I can't remember her name that did the essay, but I'm sure you can find that out and put it...
Claire Johnson.
There you go.
Johnston, sorry.
Yeah, so she made this interesting point where it's the sex in the graveyard. Obviously, you're having sex around death, and they're both close to death in the film as well, sequentially speaking in the narrative. There's a partial transcendence in sex, but it's once it's over, it's over.
Yeah,
there's
finality to it. Yeah.
So the death. As it is completely transcending to them.
Mm.
So the sex is great, but then at the end of it, you're like, what do we do now? Let's just kill ourselves and get to complete paradise together.
Yeah.
So that's the explanation.
Yeah.
They are willing to be this selfish because they think that they're going to heaven.
Yeah. Well, I can forgive the selfishness of the characters purely because in the reality that this film is established in, it's... The heart wants what the heart wants, and you can't tell it otherwise. Which I'm fine with. I'm willing to,
but
take that leap.
If you're a mature adult, then you need to reconcile.
I know, but this man is clearly not. So that's
fucking
why.
Trump.
And like you know, I was okay to take that leap and go along with that element of the story. But now, thank you for giving me context for.
That's okay.
It doesn't make me necessarily enjoy the film more. It makes me understand it more.
Yeah, but that's what we want. I mean, because there's plenty of times when you watch a film and you don't enjoy it, but you do seek out an understanding.
I just still can't get past that. There is that whole middle chunk where...
You say as you, like, wipe the
wipe
your face down in frustration.
Breath. Yeah, I just... The performances to me, in particular, the outpouring of empathy, and that whole kind of middle section where the wife and Ji-hai kind of have it out... It, to me, was soap opera level acting. It was very... it was very...
it's like a bad...
Frustrating.
A bad anime.
Yeah,
the voice acting is really subpar.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
And it was very I am feeling emotions now.
Yeah.
Versus actual nuanced character performance. And I'm not sure if that's... Because we've been really spoiled with the Japanese cinema we've watched so far.
It has been super good.
Fucking phenomenal performances. And this is just a... This is like seeing, I don't know, like an average American film, I guess. The performances aren't on that level that we're used to.
I must admit that Act 2, the middle portion, is slow and hard going.
Yes.
And I did get bored.
Yeah.
You know, like, I'm not... I suppose...
It did pick up my interest again after they... He abandoned his wife and children and met up with the courtesan again and kind of they ran off together. I was like, this is... And it's shot and constructed very well. It's just the actual performances and the narrative didn't engage me at all.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well...
That's my beef.
Yeah. Well, let's move on and say that at least the cinematography was stunning.
Yes.
I mean, it's a 60... What is it, 67?
69.
So they could do black and white. They could do color at this stage.
Well,
it
was an independent film, so it was very low budget and things.
Oh, so they were actually they actually couldn't do color.
Yeah.
Okay.
Cost effective.
I don't care because the contrast between a black and white, like, grayscale is, it's a huge service.
Black and white is almost better than color in a lot of times. Like, it can,
well, certainly like, for a movie about fucking suicide.
Like, weirdly, did you know that George Miller kind of wanted to do Mad Max Fury Road in black and white?
Huh.
And the studio was like, fuck off. Like, no.
That would be crazy.
Won't. Yeah, so he's actually gone on like online and said, like, do me a favor and turn down the saturation on your TV, watch it in black and white.
Yeah.
It's very... It's
super monotone anyway, so... Mm. It kind of...
But almost like, if you go in black and white, it's actually more vivid. You can kind of see the... Like you said, it's like similar to this film. It's that grayscale that they've got working for them.
That contrast.
Yeah, you know, it makes the dark so much darker and the whites. It really is that contrast and richness of the colours, or lack thereof, I guess.
I've only seen Mad Max once, and it was at the cinema, and I fucking loved it.
Yeah.
I think the next time I watch it, I will do a grayscale viewing.
Yeah.
With Cole.
I recommend.
Have you done it?
Yeah, I can lend you the Blu-ray if you want.
Okay. Yeah, cool. Mm. That'd be nice.
But, back to Double Suicide.
Back to Double Suicide. So...
So the cinematography and the grayscale. Yeah. That's where we were.
That's right. It was good.
I found it interesting as well, the actual opening of the film, the very first scene, is very interesting.
The puppetry sequence.
Yes. We haven't actually mentioned at this point that the film... We've kind of said it's based off this old folktale and things. What that folktale, how that was normally performed, is a puppet show.
Yeah, it's called Bunraku.
Yes.
Bunraku style.
Yes. And so kind of marionette style ancient Japanese puppets would put on this show.
Puppets would put on the show.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, puppeteers using puppets.
Right, right.
My apologies. You mean Kermit's not real?
Oh, no, he's real.
Yeah, damn straight.
All the Muppets are real.
Yeah. I've seen them. but how the film opens is behind-the-scenes footage of a puppet troupe assembling the puppets to put on this show while there is a voiceover that is a phone conversation between the director and a member of the production staff discussing the script, searching for locations, and the cinematography.
Mm.
And it's very interesting to note that in the opening scene of this film, the director himself, because the person on the other end of the phone kind of is like, the script's not good, man.
Yeah, yeah.
And the director's like, yeah, I know, but it's going to look great. And
fascinating.
It's very interesting that, like, right, he puts it out on Front Street in the first scene. It is actually the director saying, the script's not good, but what can we do? It's this classic story, but we're going to try and make it look good.
Yeah, okay.
Which is...
Well, what do you think about that? Because is that laziness? Is that a cop-out?
I think it is.
Because if you have... Remember that documentary, Jodorowsky's June... June documentary?
Mm.
What's that one called?
Jodorowsky's June.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, you take that story and you rape it.
Yeah.
And you change it and you do what you want with it and you fucking rape it.
Yeah.
So I think that's great advice. Make it your own story.
Yes.
So it seems like the director has decided to not rape it and put it forward and go, it's got holes in it and it's not that sharp, but that's the folktale and I don't want to fuck with it.
And how I'm going to put my stamp on it is by doing a film adaptation and adding in... It's going to be live action instead of puppet, but we're going to maintain elements from the puppet show still in the film,
mm-hmm.
which we'll get into in a minute.
Yes.
Like we'll stay on the cinematography, though. But, yeah, it is... I feel it is a cop-out because it is one of those things, like, the example that's coming to mind is Romeo and Juliet. Baz Luhrmann took that script as it was,
yeah.
and... amped it up and made it his own. He raped it. But he didn't change it.
Right.
Whereas I don't see why the... I'm not necessarily saying do that with this film,
well, actually,
but at least make it...
But then he didn't rape it, because he's... Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet is the same... The script is exactly the same.
But it is
but
just
visually,
absolutely... Yes, yes.
Visually, it's fucking going crazy. Right.
And because the visuals are so amped up, it seems like it is amping up the story.
Yeah, aesthetically, it's much different and gives it a different film.
Exactly.
But, a feel. But likewise, this film is effectively doing the same thing then.
Yeah.
Where it's the script has not been changed, if you want, but visually he's doing interesting things.
But
it's the same. I feel like it's very similar to Baz Luhrmann then.
But my problem is he doesn't. He opens the film by saying he's going to make it very visually interesting, and I don't feel he does until the third act.
It's there's pepperings like a
yes, but that's the problem. There's pepperings. There's not.
Oh, okay.
Whereas he kind of says it's going to look great, and it for a lot of some of it does.
I think a lot of it does. Like there's. I mean, if...
Again, I'm just always defaulting back to this middle section. There is that giant 40-minute chunk in the middle of the film that is mundane.
Yeah.
And it, in terms of the performance and the visuals. Like, it is just...
Yeah.
Brings it to a grinding halt. It starts looking great.
That's why it's slow going, because you don't have anything to latch onto for a good half an hour.
Yeah, and that's the point where the visuals could have really...
Saved it.
Yeah, and he could have, even if the story is average... As he says, he can try and tell that story and emphasize that through the visuals, but I don't feel he does.
Okay.
That's and he doesn't until the third act once he's reunited G.I. and, what's her name, the courtesan.
It's a fair point, and it's interesting because if you take the folk story in of itself as, say, the muse for inspiration.
Yeah.
If he is aware that there are portions that don't really speak to him, then naturally you wouldn't expect him to explore that portion to the extent where he's going to produce crazy, stunning visuals.
Yeah.
Because who gives a shit about this section? It doesn't speak to me.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that's what's happened. But then, of course, the start is really strong and the ending is very strong.
It is.
Those portions of the folk tale speak to him, obviously.
Mm. It's actually interesting as well. Though, in that giant mill section, it's where we also see an absence of the puppet masters.
Well, let's talk about them, because this is probably my most favourite portion of the film.
I totally agree as well.
This is
What do you call them? Because that's all I was calling them when Claire and I were watching. I was like, the puppet masters. Like, cause,
it's a good name, but it's actually... Because
they're interacting and kind of helping the characters in a way that are...
I looked it up. They're actually called Kuroko.
Oh, okay.
Which means they're kind of stagehands that will interact with the setting, the set, and they'll interact with the actors. It's supposed to be invisible.
They're dressed in black, and
The funny thing is, it's like they stand out so much, but they're supposed to be invisible.
Yeah.
But that's what gives it.
I
don't know how.
It's an interesting, and it's. It's the one thing that I found... Well, not the one thing that's really harsh in me. It's the thing I found to be most engaging and interesting about the film.
It's such an odd, strange occurrence to put that kind of thing in.
Yes.
And it is so paradoxical because they're invisible, yet they stand out so fucking much.
Yeah.
To the point where, you know, one of them hands Jihai the sword in which to kill his lover. And it's so strange because he even... recognizes that there's this invisible quote something invisible giving him a sword.
Yeah.
So strange.
Yeah. And it I don't know.
I think it's supposed to ground it back into that moment where you're thinking, oh, these actors are of course they're live actors in the film, but in reality they're puppets.
Exactly.
Recalling back from the start of the film perhaps.
Yeah.
So these are the puppet masters, I suppose.
Mm. And it worked well, like in particular that scene as well you were saying towards the end. It works well as both an interesting visual flair and like harkening back to the roots of the original production of the story with the puppet shows, but it also adds those nice little elements of like these characters are not necessarily in control of their destiny. There are these people behind their scenes that are manipulating them in some sense.
There's a lot of talk of human nature.
Yeah.
There's a lot of characters forgiving other characters because it's just human nature.
Yeah.
So... I'm putting the Kuroko down to the embodiment of human nature. They are the puppets.
Yeah.
Puppet masters.
Yes.
Human nature is the puppet master. Therefore, these guys... I mean, everybody... These two are victims, it seems.
Yes.
But then that's the... This is the most interesting part of the film for me is if they're victims, at what point are they masters of their own... domain?
Yeah.
At what point do you give go like, well, hang on, you're fucking responsible for your children.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
So there is this...
I don't think it's... That thing of, I don't think the narrative cares to make that point. It doesn't think that that is important in telling its story.
But it's still there, and I don't mind that... It doesn't have to explicitly say, this is the fucking... This is the meat and bones of the film's argument, or the,
yeah,
or the what it's putting forward. It's still there, and you're allowed to think about it.
Yeah.
I had the most... That was... I think maybe this may be the difference between you and me, because, yes, they're selfish assholes, and you should potentially hate them, or at least think ill of them.
Yeah.
But they... I'm taking it as they're all those things. Let's think about why they're those things.
Yeah.
Let's think about...
The character motivations.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just... It gives... I think... The film becomes bearable when you're allowed to just mull over at what point can you be, you know, need to follow your human nature, that primitive side of you, that, like, robotic, you know, animal side of you.
Yeah.
And at what point does...
falling into the line of society and...
Yeah, at what point does your higher thought step in and go, listen, you are an animal, but fucking...
Pull your head in.
Think about it, mate.
Yeah. You've got a business to run, you've got two young kids.
Yeah.
I don't think this character was thinking at all, especially since he married his cousin.
Yeah, good call.
It's very odd and incestuous.
Cool. But you are kind of right that there's... I'm thinking about that.
Yes.
But the character's not thinking about
that. No, and therefore the film is not thinking about that.
Mm.
It's something I think, yeah, obviously, like you're saying, like, it's up to you as an audience member to contemplate and digest and see how that affects you as an individual, but it's not ever put on the screen.
It'd be nice to see there be an internal struggle.
Yeah.
Instead you get a crybaby that's like, why don't I get what I want all the time?
Yeah,
I
want her, me. Like, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know. It's really interesting. This is one of those few films, we haven't had one like this for a while,
yeah,
where I could find very little about it.
We've had a good run.
And I've been... I actually did spend some time today and yesterday trying to delve in. Like, I also read the essay on the Criterion that came with the Criterion edition and things, but it just... Other than that, there's very little actually out there, like, even on the internet about the film.
The Wikipedia page is super skinned.
Yeah, and even some big kind of film books I've got at home, like, no mention. It's very... Not much out there, which is kind of interesting.
I guess. Be suggestive of, like, of... It's... What do you call it? It's legacy.
Yeah.
It's kind of maybe fallen into obscurity. If it wasn't for the collection,
so.
I don't think a lot of people would give it any time.
No, no. And, well, that's the thing, like, and when watching it, I was like, the thing that made me connect with the film was the Puppet Masters. That element is a very interesting idea that I've never seen done before, and I think he executed it well, but other than that, the film has very little going for it, I feel.
Apparently that he does that in a lot of his films.
Oh, okay.
And it's a recurring theme. Which is nice.
Mm. He's got a motif.
Yeah, he's got his thing.
Yeah, but I think without that, this film would really...
Absolutely. Yeah, it's got interesting themes.
Yeah.
I'm saying that it's shot the whole shot well.
Yeah, I'll agree with that. As a whole piece, it is. But I think my problem is I keep coming back to that giant 40-minute chunk in the middle that's where I kind of turned on it, I guess.
The director, even.
Yeah.
Everybody knows.
Yes. It's established, yeah. But, yeah, you are right. It is shot very well. In particular, the finale, I think, is shot exceptionally well.
Mm. Yeah, the hanging over the hill looks really stunning. And you have... I mean, I really liked that sequence where you have Jihai killing his lover. What's it? Kaharu?
Yep.
And then I loved the camera pan where there's just heaps of these black silhouettes ready to hang him.
Yeah.
I mean, no one's there, but they're there.
Yes.
And that was striking.
And I thought it was interesting as well, like the idea of them going out into the wilderness and outside of society to kill themselves, and then after they die, we are given static shots of all the building locations we've been at previous to the film in the city. It was like this nice kind of interesting thing of like the added element of escape he was kind of laying in there visually, which was like if he had peppered in more of that throughout it, I think it would have been stronger.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is only in the beginning and the end that you get the real flair of this talent of filmmaking.
So it's all right.
Yeah, it's okay. It's okay.
It's pretty good.
I'm not going to go that far.
I'm going to say it's pretty good.
All right. This would probably be the point in the podcast where I would normally say, do you want to hear some trivia? But I got nothing this week.
Well, we've tackled actually quite a bit just with our discussions.
Yeah. But in terms of actual kind of trivia that wouldn't be actual production stuff, like, yeah, everything we would have gone into normally, I found nothing. No real major awards the film was nominated or won for. Not
it's
much.
It has no legacy.
Yeah, it's been slipped into obscurity.
Except for that of the Criterion Collection.
Well, I'll talk about the actual Criterion Edition itself at this point. The film is still available as a one-disc DVD, and it's also available to stream on Hulu or iTunes. But the physical copy comes with the essay we've talked about.
That's a really good essay.
Yeah.
And I think that if you're watching the film, you should definitely read that essay.
Yeah, it's also available online on the Criterion website to have a look at.
It gives it much context, much needed context.
Yeah. But yeah, that's it. No special features even.
Fucking dumb.
Yeah. Sorry. It's a very skint edition. So yeah, I guess if we got nothing else, this will probably wrap us up for this week's episode, looking at Double Suicide.
Okay.
We've got a good one though next week when we have our first Kubrick in the collection.
Awesome.
Yeah.
What is it?
Spartacus.
Nice.
The 1960.
Oh, I have not seen that.
Really?
I've seen many Kubricks, but I have not seen that.
I've started to do my research for this one. Like, I'm really looking forward to it. Yeah.
I don't know why I haven't seen it as well. I fucking love Kubrick.
Yeah. It's the one Kubrick film you don't necessarily associate with being a Kubrick film.
Okay.
Because it's... I'll get into that.
Do you mean just because it's one of his earlier ones that he hasn't quite...
But even though his earlier ones, like the ones that are actually in the collection, like Paths of Glory and The Killing and things, like they are very clearly Kubrick films.
Okay.
But, yeah, I'll save all this for next week. It's a little teaser, I guess.
Okay.
But, if you have any comments or queries, please send us an email at thecriterionquest@gmail.com or hit us up on Twitter @CriterionQuest. And also keep an eye out on the Criterion subreddit for a posting of Tom's artwork based on Double Suicide. Yeah.
Yeah. Art. Art's awesome.
Yeah.
It's cool, man.
But, I got nothing else. So.
Swish Harvey. Stop breathing on the fucking microphone.
He likes it. He's hot and sweaty now. He's got his tongue out. But for this week's episode, I'm Chris.
I'm Tom. See you next time.